As you probably know, you have a certain amount of time, and note that when you have green, you can keep talking. When it's yellow, you only have 2 minutes left. When it's red, you are done, unless we're still questioning you. If we're still questioning you, you need to stay up there and answer. Okay? So, with that, we will start with FTC versus Zapaz, and we have Patillo for Zapaz. Come on up. I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name. Patillo.
I'm from Texas, and everyone thinks it's Patillo until they... May it please the court, Mike Patillo on behalf of the appellants. There are three distinct issues in this case, but they all raise the same fundamental question, and that is, can the Federal Trade Commission recover tens of millions of dollars in damages purportedly on behalf of consumers without proving the extent to which consumers actually were injured by Zapaz's MITRE violations? The FTC won a $37 million judgment against Zapaz under Section 19 of the FTC Act. Section 19 permits a court to award such relief as the court finds necessary to redress injury from the violation of an FTC rule. But the FTC never proved how many of the 58,000 customers who bought PPE from Zapaz actually were harmed by its failure to meet its shipping times.
And let me ask you on that $12 million. I know that that is a little bit different from the rest because it says it was never delivered, not just untimely delivered. And y'all have said, well, but you haven't proven. But why wouldn't Zapaz be able to show, oh, it was delivered? Because Zapaz is the one who either delivered or didn't. So just saying you didn't prove it, well, they proved as best they could, which is showing that there was no indication of delivery. But if you all had proof of delivery, why wouldn't you give that proof?
Well, there are a couple different issues I'd like to address. First, the fact is that the FTC, is in a Section 19 case, as this court said in the Turner decision, is just like any other civil plaintiff seeking to obtain damages. And so the FTC bears the burden of proof. And so unless there's some legal mechanism for flipping the burden to Zapaz, the question is whether they made a prima facie showing in the first instance. And here, the question is really, it's partly procedural. And what the issue is that the court didn't really give Zapaz the chance to contest this at trial. The way this played out was that at summary judgment, the FTC sought a single unitary theory for $37 million. It cited a scenario from the Jenkins Declaration that only talked about PPE that was delivered late. There was no mention of this subsidiary $12 million figure in Zapaz's summary judgment motion. It was buried at paragraph 483 of its proposed findings of fact. So the issue was never actually teed up for us to respond at summary judgment because they never sought relief on this figure. And not only that, Zapaz did in its summary judgment opposition at ROA 430203. They took on the FTC's theory because the FTC's theory was, they said, well, if we find that there's a tracking number and we can't correlate that with delivery information, we're just going to assume it was never delivered. And Zapaz said at summary judgment, that doesn't cut it because proof that the FTC doesn't know it was delivered isn't proof it was delivered. And so there clearly was, we did dispute that issue at summary judgment. And then how did the FTC respond to that? The FTC represented, we are not relying on that calculation and it is immaterial to the issue of consumer harm. So under Supreme Court precedent, that is an express waiver. They never asked for the $12 million figure. And then when we raised the issue, they waived it. They said, we're not relying on that at all. And the court has no discretion. Courts can overlook a forfeiture, but courts have no discretion to overlook an express waiver. So they said, this is not our case.
But then they came back and it was their case. So, I mean, if you're going one, blah, 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 things can go back and forth some during a case. So when they brought it back, why didn't y'all show, oh no, they were all delivered?
Well, I think again, I have two responses to that. The first is that procedurally it's improper because a 56G motion is decided on the summary judgment motion. It's not intended to be a separate beast where you go out and litigate something else. The question is, what issues were basically resolved by the summary judgment motion itself that we can give, but falling short of full relief? So the idea that then you have a second bite at the apple at 56G is just not how that's designed to work. But the fact is, we did come forward with a declaration at 56G. Mr. Makinojia came forward, they offered an affidavit, and he explained exactly why the FTC's theory doesn't work. And he said, listen, you know, their theory is that whenever there was a tracking number that didn't match up with delivery information, the court assumes it wasn't ordered. But he explained, he said, listen, we would create multiple shipping, we'd print out different shipping labels all the time for an order, and that would automatically generate these tracking numbers with UPS or FedEx, but that didn't mean we would actually use them. Sometimes we might print three labels and we would go forward and, you know, and just only use one of those labels to ship the entire order. So it explained why their whole methodology was wrong. And we also submitted additional evidence in the declaration where they went through and looked at things on the back end with the information that Zapaz had, and they found a representative sample of 307 of these orders that fell into this category of supposedly not known to be delivered, and said, according to Zapaz's record, we believe it was delivered. So, you know, this was clearly enough to create at least a material issue of disputed fact for trial. And the district court just heard none of that. It said, you know, anyone who's been paying attention here would already know that this has been decided. It said that despite the fact that the court itself had said at summary judgment that the FTC had made no showing as to the damages for those who never received any product. And instead, how did the court resolve this? It said, well, I already decided that when I affirmed the magistrate's decision on denying your motion to exclude the Miles and Jenkins reports. That's not how Rule 56G works. Rule 56G is tied to the summary judgment motion. 56G does not exist to say that if you fail to challenge the substance of evidence in a motion to exclude, that suddenly the court gets to treat all of that as established fact. I mean, imagine the ramifications for litigation. If every time you move to exclude an expert at Daubert on the grounds, say, that they're not qualified, or for whatever other sort of technical reason where you're challenging their methodology without challenging the substance of it, and then if you lose your Daubert motion, the idea that a court would suddenly say, all right, well, then everything in that expert's report is now established fact, that's frankly not how litigation works. It's not how it's ever worked. It would massively change the nature of district court litigation, but that's essentially what the district court did here. And it's not just, so here we had, it was challenged at summary judgment. The FTC affirmatively waived the $12 million at summary judgment. The district court rejected it at summary judgment. We challenged it again at Rule 56G, and yet the district court ignored all of that. In one paragraph, it just said, well, you know, I already resolved this in denying the procedural motion. And frankly, that just cannot be sustained. It fails factually, legally, and procedurally. If there are any other questions about the $12 million, I'm happy to address those now. If not, I'll turn to the other issues.
Well, what I'm also wondering about in sort of in general, I understand that you're not happy with the $37 million, but you all haven't really said that your client's company didn't lie in saying, we'll send it out today, we'll get it, you know, where they were trying to get people in the middle of that awful beginning of the COVID pandemic. People were going, I need this, I need this, I need this. And they were saying, we'll give it to you, we'll give it to you, we'll give it to you now. And then it wasn't now. Y'all are not denying that. So doesn't that seem like you should owe something? You're not you personally, obviously, but your client.
I think I'm not judgment proof here. But no, absolutely. And there's two ways to look at this. And you know, one of them is, yes, consumers were in a frenzy. The other was that Zapaz was in a frenzy. I mean, the earth was shifting beneath their feet. They had an established shipping model that they'd been using very successfully. And all of that, they had the rug pulled out from under them. Did they handle that as they should have according to MITRE? Absolutely not. My client, Mr. Makinojia, had never heard of MITRE. He had no idea what it was. Our view is they were just businessmen trying to deal with the situation as best as they could, and they made mistakes. That said, there are findings against us on this issue with respect to whether it was violated. And, you know, we respect the standard of review. We're not going to go charge at windmills on an issue like that. Mistakes were made by this company, and we have to live with that. We have to own up to that. But the question is, what relief is appropriate? And $37 million against a small business where there is absolutely no proof. Of course, people were harmed. Of course, there were some people who were upset that they got their PPE late, and maybe some people who didn't have use for it. But there were 58,000 orders here, and it's preposterous to assume that every single one of those people was somehow harmed by the late delivery, and not only harmed by the late delivery, but harmed in the full amount of their purchase price. That's just not how the law works. We don't assume reliance. Individual reliance is an element of a fraud claim. And this court held in the Torres case that, you know, we don't infer class-wide reliance. Excuse me, it wasn't a holding in Torres. It was but the court expressly distinguished consumer cases like this one and said, we don't accept a class-wide inference of reliance in consumer cases because people make, consumers buy for any number of different reasons. It's based on their own personal idiosyncratic choice. So you can't just assume that all consumers rely on all misrepresentations. Torres's reasoning basically completely eviscerates the presumption of reliance here. And it's easy to see why that's true. It's simply, I mean, we can just ask from our own experience. Do we rely on every single representation that is on the package?
But what about the 12 million that was products never delivered? Certainly you must concede that you owe that.
Well, we draw a distinction in terms of what the appropriate relief is. And that distinction is we absolutely, with respect to the 25 million, we absolutely dispute that full refunds is an appropriate amount for late delivery. Because the basic damages principles are, throughout fraud law, whatever remedy you give the consumer, you have to account for the value of what they received. And here the consumers received exactly what they ordered, they just got it late. With respect to the 12 million, that reasoning doesn't apply. We have to admit, there's no way to deny that if someone ordered from us and they didn't get their PPE, then of course they're absolutely entitled to a refund. We can't dispute that. There's no way to lessen the damages. But the question is, how many people didn't actually get their product? And the 12 million figure is completely unreliable. But beyond that, we were just not really given the opportunity to dispute this at trial, which is where we should have been allowed to dispute that part. We're not saying full refunds aren't appropriate. We're just saying it's a lot less than 12 million in terms of the total number of orders who didn't get their PPE. So the FTC has come forward with, so on the presumption of reliance, our argument is that, listen, it's not in the statute. The FTC, Congress didn't provide for a presumption of reliance in the FTC Act, and that is reason enough to reject it. The Supreme Court has made clear in AMG Capital that courts must apply the FTC Act as written, and they're not free to make up new rules just to make the FTC's job easier.
One thing you said is, the court should be reversed, but you haven't said, okay, what if we did reverse? What happens next? What is your contention on that?
Well, our contention is that we use the word reverse in our brief for a reason. We meant reverse and render judgment in our favor. We did not say reverse and remand for further proceedings. We said reversal as our request.
So why should you all win entirely when it's clear, I'm sorry, I'm loud, when it's clear that at least some people really were injured by you all, given what we talked about earlier, that your client did lie, or at least say something that wasn't true?
Well, I mean, we thought that there was an issue for trial. Before trial, the court told the FTC several times, I am not buying your argument that every consumer is entitled to full refunds. You must come forward with proof of a lesser amount of injury, less than full refunds. And the court said that at summary judgment. The court said that again. It issued a pretrial order that said, what are the issues for trial? And one of them is FTC, what is the evidence of, you have to come forward at the trial with evidence of some amount less than full refunds. And what did the FTC say? At ROA 689495, the FTC said, sorry, we are resting on the existing record. So the court, the FTC had this chance, and it said, I'm sorry, Judge, you've told me this is my burden to prove it, and I'm not going to prove it. I'm standing on my rule that, you know, full refunds are required. And the FTC made a decision to live or die by that ruling, and if it's reversed, then it needs to die by that ruling. It shouldn't. I see my time is up. May I complete my answer?
Sure.
At the apple after basically playing chicken with the judge, daring it to come to appeal and then losing and then going back to court and then doing exactly what the district court asked it to do in the first place. And for that reason, it is absolutely proper to reverse and render judgment in our favor. With respect to the $12 million, our position of why it's appropriate to reverse and render in our favor on the $12 million as well is they expressly waived this issue at summary judgment.
Yeah, you've already talked about that. Thank you, and you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry about this screaming. I have such a loud voice, I don't really need a microphone. Okay, now we will hear from Hoffman on behalf of the Federal Trade Commission.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case involves an egregious and undisputed violation of the FTC's merchandise rule, also known as MITRE, that, as I think Mr. Patillo acknowledged, caused serious harm to consumers. The district court properly ordered refunds in accordance with the plain language of Section 19 of the FTC Act and the MITRE rule. I'm going to try and talk first about the $25 million for the late shipped orders and then go to the $12 million for the undelivered orders. Unless the court wants to hear it in the other order, in which case I'll do it the way you want.
Well, I just wonder, since we just heard the reverse and render, if we ended up reversing anything, what would be your position on what we should do, reverse and X? Should it be render or should it be remand?
No, I think, what? I think if you were to reverse, which...
And I'm not saying we will or won't, I'm just asking.
I think you shouldn't, but if you were to reverse, I think the proper course would be to remand for correction of whatever errors the court identifies in what the district court did. But I want to emphasize that the district court has, on a Section 19, very broad discretion in terms of the remedy. The statute says the court may grant such relief as the court finds necessary to redress injury to consumers, including but not limited to damages and or a refund of money. So those are separate.
Could take a new trial?
Conceivably, the district court could take a new trial if there was some error that the district court made. Again, there was very little left for trial here because most of the case was resolved on summary judgment. There was really very little defense as to liability, and most of that was resolved on summary judgment. So really the only issues for trial went to the remedies, you know, the FTC's position, you know, going back to,
are you saying that the FTC offered up a $12.2 million figure as a damage figure on summary judgment?
Certainly, I just want to bracket the word damage there for a second, but certainly yes, we put that number in our statement of undisputed material facts, and Zapaz was fully on notice of it. They mentioned it.
Say that it was immaterial, though. It was immaterial to the issue of consumer harm. That was the FTC's position at summary judgment.
Well, our position at summary judgment was that we were entitled to the full $37 million for both the late shipped and the unshipped merchandise. We put in a declaration which gave the value of the unshipped merchandise Zapaza was on notice of that. They did not put in any evidence to controvert that. Instead, they sought to exclude the declarations. They sought to exclude that evidence, and the district court said, no, I'm not going to exclude it. So then later on, we pointed out that this was no longer really in dispute because we had put the evidence in. They were aware of it. They did not controvert it.
But you said it was immaterial to the issue of consumer harm. So why would a party push back on something that's not being offered as evidence of consumer harm?
I mean, the statement that we said, the statement they're pointing to is in the reply brief, by which point they would have already had the opportunity to push back.
Where it is, though, we're here today, the FTC is advocating for a number that it, in its pleadings, stated was not material to the issue of consumer harm. I'm trying to reconcile where the number came from and how the court came to rely on it if the FTC wasn't arguing.
Yeah, I mean, the FTC was arguing at that point that the court should award the full $37 million. We provided an alternate number, but what we made clear was that in that footnote that he's referring to was that what we were asking for was not simply $12 million, but $37 million. As it happened, based on the way the summary judgment came out, the FTC thought it was appropriate to seek relief under Rule 56G. The court agreed that there was no dispute. Based on the summary judgment record, there was no dispute of material fact as to this point, and it was proper. And again, this is a discretionary decision. If there's no dispute of material fact, it's proper for the district court to treat that as undisputed for purposes of summary judgment.
What does the magistrate's report say about the issue of the damages?
The magistrate judge's R&R says that that it thought the FTC had established the fact of injury, which is sort of goes to the first point of Zapaza's argument, but that we hadn't adequately established the appropriate relief. So that's what the magistrate judge held. And the district court initially went along with that. But then, as you see, in a series of orders, it took a closer look at the evidence and decided that, this is what's really in dispute for trial and this is what's really not in dispute for trial.
Well, I'm trying to get to that point because I think the magistrate judge's report also says that the FTC had not presented any lesser amount of damages necessary to redress consumer injury other than the $37 million figure.
Yeah, the magistrate judge's report does say that. I mean, I think...
That was the summary judgment disposition. Before we get to 56G, that's the summary judgment.
Right. Well, insofar as the magistrate judge said that, I think the district court later clarified that, in fact, we had presented evidence as to the $12 million. And again, there's no dispute here.
I thought the district court adopted the report and recommendation.
It did, but then in a subsequent order, it concluded, based on the summary judgment record, that there was no material dispute as to the $12 million figure. So at that point, that's the point at which Zapaz first attempted to introduce some evidence disputing this. I do want to make two points about this. One is that,
Well, where in the record, before we move on, where in the record did the FTC change its argument and say, no, the $12 million is material to the issue of consumer harm, and we'd like that to be awarded based upon undelivered product?
When we moved under 56G to deem fact established for trial, which is the order in which the court made that determination. I don't have the docket number in front of me on that, but that was what we asked for.
But in your 56G, you also state that Zapaz is challenging the $12 million damages number, that's a number that is not a number that is settled pre-trial. It's a disputed number.
I think our position in that filing was that it was not, there was no genuine dispute established in the summary judgment record. I don't think there's any legitimate dispute. Going back to Judge Haynes's point, MITRE puts a burden on the shipper to keep adequate records. If you don't keep adequate records, there's a presumption of noncompliance. And in this case, the only evidence they've put in is sort of a declaration from Zapaz's owner, which, you know, consists of, you know, it doesn't show that products were actually made. It largely relies on evidence of other people, from other people. And, you know, it wasn't part of the summary judgment record, so I don't think the district court had to consider it. But, you know, so my view is that we clearly established there was no dispute of material fact at this point in the summary judgment record. The district court agreed with that ultimately and found that it was appropriate to treat that as established for trial. That's an abuse of discretion standard, and I think the court should go ahead. I do want to make sure that I get to the merits of the $25 million for the late shipped merchandise. And, you know, what I'd like to make clear is you know, that the way MITRE works, it's a comprehensive scheme. You have to have a good faith basis for your shipping representations. If you don't have, if you can't ship on time, you need to contact consumers and offer them the option to either consent to delayed shipping or get an immediate refund. And if you don't do that, then your obligation is to cancel the orders and provide a refund. And but you can't do what Zapaz did here, which is ignore all that. And I understand Mr. Patillo says that, you know, they didn't know about MITRE, but, you know, it's well established that ignorance of the law is not an excuse. You got to follow the rules. You can't do what they did and ship the product and then keep the money and say, well, you know, you already got it. That's unilaterally changing the terms of the contract that people agreed
on. But why is this in the FTC arena as opposed to the person that, you know, got the thing way late and therefore couldn't use it? Why wouldn't they be the one to say, no, I need my money back, blah, blah, blah?
Well, as you can see, many of them did. Many of them complained to state attorney generals. They filed lots of complaints. I mean, litigating something like this is, you know, quite difficult for an individual person, and that's why the FTC has the authority to seek redress on behalf
of people. Right, but I mean, if they are complaining, then that's some evidence. Your opponent says that you don't have any evidence, but that's some evidence if they're complaining, even if they can't file a lawsuit about $20 or whatever.
It's absolutely evidence, and, you know, there is plenty of evidence in this record, and we've cited it, that consumers did rely on these representations. There is no evidence, apart from speculation, that anyone would have purchased these products from wristband.com, you know, absent the representations and, you know, the extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic.
So that's what supports your $25 million in your view, that there were a lot of complaints, there was a lot of delay, there was all of this la la, and that's enough, in your opinion.
That certainly is enough.
And what is your best case for the argument that is enough for you all to get the $25 million?
Well, I mean, we've cited the Jensen case, which talks about situations in which you know, there's evidence can create, it can be sufficient to support a common inference. But again, there are several ways in which you can get to this point. As I've said, you know, in this case, the facts of the merchandise rule really, you know, the violation doesn't turn on the misrepresentation. Whether or not consumers relied on this promise, they were entitled to get their money back under the plain terms of the merchandise rule. So you don't need to reach the reliance issue here. You could also do it applying the presumption, which is the way the district court did and the way other courts have done it. And that's a perfectly fine way to do it as well. So, I mean, you can affirm the district court's judgment either because reliance wasn't required at all, and that goes to the plain language of Section 19, which doesn't say anything about reliance or misrepresentations or anything like that, or you can look at the evidence in the record, which shows that many people, in fact, did rely on this, and there's no evidence that anyone didn't. And of course, the reason why people make representations like, you know, ships today, guaranteed in stock, is because they expect people to rely on those. You know, that's sort of a common sense inference.
Opponent's argument is, okay, I wish we'd gotten it there sooner, but they finally did get it. Why should they get to keep it and get the money. Now, I understand the $25 million, if we just simply said a one-sentence affirm, the $25 million would be in the bucket, and the people would have to come ask for the money back, and some of them won't, and it'll go back to Zapas. But my question is, you know, what is your answer to that point that they're making? Right. Why do I get to keep this and get my money back?
Right. So, I mean, and there certainly are situations where return of the property would be appropriate. I mean, Zapas has posited various examples involving, you know, televisions, which are like big things. And you know, I would agree there that in that circumstance, you know, if there's a merchandise rule, district court probably couldn't say you get your refund, you get a refund, and you get to keep the TV. In this case, it's a little bit different. You're dealing with small items. It costs a lot to return them. It's not clear that they have much residual value. But most importantly, Zapas never asked for the products back. I don't think they want the products back. They don't have a warehouse to store them. I don't know that they could sell them. What the district court did here was the best that it could do based on the violation, which was to say, all right, you know, under MITRE, consumers had the right to a refund if they wanted one. So the remedy that it imposed, which was not the remedy that we asked for, was to create a claims process whereby if consumers weren't satisfied, they could get their money back. And just so you know, I mean, typically when we have a claims process like that, about 20% of people will respond to the offer. So, although it's $25 million, you know, I would expect that not all of that, or you know, the bulk of that will actually end up going back to Zapas. But I can't predict that. But that's based on our experience. But yes, I mean, this is not a one-size-fits-all regime by any means. And the district court has broad discretion to order returns if it sees fit, and not in cases where it doesn't make sense. And impose different remedies if it seems appropriate. You know, the statute says any remedy the court finds necessary. And so that's broad discretion. I mean, here, there was no alternative calculation of remedies proposed by Zapas. So we put in our numbers. They put in nothing. They said, you know, what we did wasn't good enough. And, you know, initially the judge agreed, but the judge, I think, correctly took another look at the law and decided that both under the plain language of MITRE, which requires refunds, and sort of under the general principles that courts have applied in cases involving fraudulent representations, and just the diamonds and rhinestones hypothetical, that you know, a refund is the appropriate remedy. The court certainly could have ordered return of the product as a condition. Again, that wasn't something that anyone asked for. I don't think it's something anyone wants. So the question here is, did the district court abuse its discretion in ordering the remedy that it did? And I don't think it did. You know, we haven't really talked about the presumption at all, but you know, I just want to emphasize that, you know, Zapas seems to be taking the position that a presumption can only be created by act of Congress. I just don't think that's correct. Congress specifies what you have to prove, but then courts decide in how one may go about proving it, typically. And courts have adopted a large number of presumptions, and they're not just to assist the plaintiff or the party with the burden of proof, they're there to assist the court. And I think the Basic versus Levinson case makes that very clear. You know, the Supreme Court says, you know, court presumptions, let me find the language. Presumptions typically serve to assist courts in managing situations in which direct proof for one reason or another is rendered difficult. And they're based on considerations of probability, judicial economy, fairness. It's not something that Congress needs to create. They've not created a single case for that proposition. And as I said, as we've pointed out, there are numerous different presumptions that courts have created that don't that aren't established by statute, even though they're applied in the context of statutory enforcement schemes. Again, in this case, however, you really don't need to reach the presumption issue because you know, the plain language of MITRE says people are entitled to refunds. They were injured both because the contract was breached, they didn't get what was promised, and they didn't get the refund that they were entitled to. You know, you can't, you know, customers were entitled to get their money back and they didn't. That's an injury. And the district court's order does the best that it can to try to redress that injury by giving the consumers who got late shipped goods an opportunity to get the refunds that the rule requires. There doesn't seem to be any dispute here that customers who got no goods at all are entitled to refunds. They're simply challenging the 12 million figure. And again, that's based on the record evidence that we put in. They put in no contrary evidence at summary judgment. I think it was well within district court's discretion. Notwithstanding whatever, a stray comment in the reply brief, it was well within district court's discretion to say, looking at this record, there's really no dispute of material fact as to this. I'm going to deem that established for trial. I see my time is almost up. Does the court have any further?
Well, I just on that one, on the immaterial, you just meant it was immaterial to overall the need for everybody to get their money back.
I think that's correct.
Versus if the district court or we thought there is a difference, then it would be material to us. But you just felt it was immaterial because of that.
I think that's exactly right, okay. Judge Haynes. Further questions? If there's no further questions, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll hear the rebuttal from Patillo.
Patillo, yes. Thank you very much. I have an awful lot to cover in a very short period of time, so I will try to move quickly. First of all, I'd like to address this notion that the court was just exercising its broad discretion in the Section 19 damages award. The district court did no such thing. The district court relied on legal rules. It relied on a presumption of reliance, which was a legal rule to find the fact of injury. And it announced a second legal rule that full refunds are required anytime there is a fraud in the selling. Those are two legal issues that the court decided. They're reviewed de novo. They are not exercises of discretion. Counsel cannot point to a single place in the record where the court exercised discretion with respect to the damages figures. It certainly made no findings of fact as Rule 52 would require to support the damages figures. So this lives or dies by the legal rules the court adopted. With respect to this idea about return of the product, that's completely a red herring. The issue is not that Zapaz wants the product back. Of course it doesn't. The issue is that under fundamental damages principles, widely accepted in every area of fraud law, the general rule is whatever remedy you give the consumer, you have to account for the value of what they received. And they can hear consumers got exactly what they ordered. So they got to use it over the course. They may have got it a day late, a week late, even if they got it a month late. The pandemic was 3 years long, and so there's every reason to believe that they got their money's worth for what they bought. Were they miffed that they didn't get it as advertised? Absolutely, I'm sure. But is that a cognizable injury? I don't know. I get packages late all the time, and no refund or no remedy shows up to my door. But what I can tell you is if there was some lesser amount, the FTC had to prove it. And that's what the district court repeatedly said is, prove to me what's the harm from lateness. And that was never proved. With respect to the 12 million, the idea that Zapaz was on notice. Yes, Zapaz was on notice of the 12 million figure at summary judgment because we responded to it and we said this doesn't work. But that doesn't mean that the issue was teed up. We were aware that it was in their papers, but the issue was not teed up in such a way that required us to respond. Why did we move to exclude it instead of challenge it, with other evidence at summary judgment? Because they had not teed up the issue as a summary judgment issue. They never asked for the 12 million on summary judgment. So we said, well, what do we do? Well, let's exclude it going forward for trial, which is when this issue should be reached, when we should address this question. And what we just heard was, well, what was the immaterial? He said, after we wrote that, we had second thoughts at Rule 56G. So the notion that Zapaz was somehow supposed to respond to this on pain of having it decided against them, when they didn't even know that's what they were pursuing?
Then why not reverse and remand? Because if both sides had this really different view of where things were and what things were, and the district court did some other thing and so on, that all this confusion, then it would seem like that's a remand as opposed to a render.
Well, Your Honor, because there was no confusion. I can't imagine anything that is clearer than saying we are not, the FTC said, we are not relying on this. It's unequivocal, and it is immaterial to the issue of consumer harm. If they're not relying on that $12 million as a separate category of damages, there was no confusion on their part. They expressly waived it, and they're bound by that waiver.
Well, no, because they thought all of them should get the money back, but if the district court thought differently, or we think differently, then that is something they were confused about in writing. I'm sure they're sorry they wrote that sentence.
Well, and respectfully, I mean, people are sorry about things they say all the time. Criminal defendants say things all the time, and you know what? And we hold them to those waivers. People go to jail for saying things that they regret later. I don't think it's too much to hold a sophisticated agency.
Well, but the
agency.
District court had a different view.
Well, the
both sides. So that's important.
Respectfully, the district court did not have a different view at summary judgment. It said you have made no showing as to any lesser amount. And that's a holding at 56 at summary judgment. You have not made that showing. And 56G is supposed to say, well, what can we salvage? What's established for trial? And the idea that you would turn around and say, it's established for trial, what I just held, you've made no showing as to? If you're going to make a change like that, you need to reconcile that. You need to offer some reason for changing your mind. And the district court did not do that here. It didn't address the waiver. It didn't address any of Zapaz's actual arguments at summary judgment or at 56G. It just said, well, all done, nothing to see here. And frankly, you shouldn't decide $12 million of damages against a small business with that sort of procedure. The law doesn't allow it. And I apologize, my time is up. I'm happy to answer any further questions if there are any.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate both sides, and the case is now under submission.
Thank you very much.